there are days when you'd have the upwind engine at max power and the downwind engine in max reverse to keep the airplane straight to get up the ramp when it was blowing hard.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 8 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. I'm your host, Dan Bolton. I must say, folks, this episode has a lot to live up to after Kevin Bowe's epic two-part episode this week. Wow. So much amazing feedback from you guys, all loving that show. But don't be afraid, everyone. Do not be afraid. If you thought Kevin's episode was good, holy moly, hold on to your life jackets because you're about to get knocked off your whipline floats. That's right, folks. It's an episode I've been so keen to get out to you all this week. After hearing my first episode all about the Mallard, Michael Steers got in touch to tell me his story about flying Mallards in the US Virgin Islands. This is the absolute definition of a dream job. This episode is also a long one, so once again, the Seaplane Spotlight and Q&A will stay warming the bench. All I want to say before we jump into the show is don't forget to write me a review on Apple Podcasts. They are starting to come in slowly, and it's great to see. Now, a quick shout out to a great review from a guy called Float Flying Fish. And the title is one of the best aviation podcasts out. 3 exclamation marks. It's a lot of exclamation marks, but it's a good title, Float Flying Fish. And his review reads, I have been absolutely loving every episode that has been put out so far. If you're a pilot or not, couldn't recommend this podcast more. Pre-warning, you'll probably want to get a float rating after listening. Laughing, crying face. Being in the float plane industry myself, I can say that you are getting incredible insight into our industry and stories that you just wouldn't hear unless you knew these pilots personally. Absolutely brilliant. Another 3 exclamation marks after brilliant. Epic. Thank you, Float Flying Fish, for that. And I've actually seen some of his work on YouTube. You can check him out. He has some really cool videos flying seaplanes, and you guys should go have a look. But now, folks, the time has come. Let's throw a tin of oil in the engine. Swipe our Carnet credit card 15 times to try and approve an Avgas transaction. And right on schedule, we'll get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A lot.
Michael Steers, welcome to On The Step, mate. How are you going?
Great. Thanks, Dan. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's really cool to have you on the show, mate. I'm really excited. You're now the second person from Florida that I've interviewed. The last one was Janessa on last Saturday's episode. And I'm really getting the rough end of the stick here, mate. It's 5:30 in the morning, Darwin time. You're sitting back drinking pina coladas, nearly watching the sunset in Florida. I think I might have to change this up in the future, hey?
Yeah, really. Next time we'll do it the other way around.
Yeah. maybe when the show becomes a bit more popular, I can have a bit more authority on my guests. But I guess one thing it does prove is I'm committed to making sure that my guests are around that drinking hour, so at least their stories might be a little bit more fruitful, you know what I mean?
Well, thanks for accommodating me. I appreciate it.
No, man, it's awesome. Your story is going to be amazing. I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't heard much of it myself, but you used to fly Mallards in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico as well, I believe.
Yes.
Twin Otters as well. Really cool story that we're about to hear. You're now a Gulfstream captain in Florida?
Yes.
How's the COVID situation affecting you in that job?
Well, everything is completely shut down. There's nothing going on at all. So we're just all waiting for this to pass. And we have great hopes that the corporate end of things will pick up quicker because it's a more sterile environment for those that can afford to travel in that way before the airlines get going. So we're all just very hopeful that things will get going soon. It's been going on long enough.
Yeah, it's terrible times at the moment, especially in the aviation industry. So yeah. Obviously wishing you all the best that you can get back into the air as soon as possible and back to a bit more of a normal lifestyle. But, mate, we're here to talk all about flying boats and float planes, which you seem to be an expert on. Mate, let's start back at the beginning of your career, and you know what got you into aviation, and were flying boats right on the radar from the beginning?
Well, basically, there's been four seaplane operations that have influenced my life and my career. The first one inspired me to be a pilot. The second two I ended up working for full time, and then the fourth one I worked for part time. So the first three operations were indeed in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And for your listeners that might not be familiar with where they are, that's a group of three islands that are located just east of Puerto Rico. And they're classified as a U.S. territory. So the American flag is flying over the islands. The main island is St. Thomas, where I lived. That's the busiest island and where the most commerce is. The smallest island is St. John. That's about 2 or 3 miles to the east, and that's mostly covered with national parkland. And then the largest island is St. Croix, which is 40 miles to the south, and that's the quietest of the three islands and mainly an agricultural-based economy. So that's where I grew up, in St. Thomas. They call themselves the American Paradise. And it definitely was back in those days. It was very quiet and very innocent and just an amazing place to grow up.
So you actually grew up there as well? Were you born over there in the Virgin Islands?
No, I was actually born in the States. And when I was 2 or 3 years old, my mother got divorced and remarried. And then we moved down after that happened. I was about 4 years old when we moved there. And during that time, there was a seaplane operation going on there called Antilles Airboats. And it was started in the early 60s by a man by the name of Charlie Blair. And this is one of these iconic guys that you hear about. He was a aviator like there's nothing today. He had over 40,000 hours in his career.
Wow.
And he was in the military and ended up being the chief pilot with Pan Am, and flew the giant Sikorsky S-44 four-engine airboats and the Boeing 314 airboats across the Atlantic. He was quite a guy. After he retired, he moved to St. Croix, and with his movie star wife, Maureen O'Hara, by the way, and started Antilles Airboats with a couple of Grumman Gooses. And over the years, it grew and became a fleet of over 20 aircraft, including a PBY, and he had a couple of he had an S-44 Sikorsky airboat there and a Shorts Sandringham. It was just, he filled the skies every day with radial engines.
What an incredible lineup of aircraft.
Oh, incredible. My house was right there on the harbor, on the south side of the harbor. The seaplane base was on the north side of the harbor, but those airplanes would take off and land all day. As a young boy, of course, every time I heard those engines roar, I would race down to the water's edge to watch them go or climb a tree and watch them take off. I mean, I was totally mesmerized by it.
There's no doubt that that would have been an inspiration to watch those flying boats back in the day off right in your backyard.
And even my school was located near the entrance to the harbor, and during recess my friends and I would make a path down to the rocks and be down there swimming in the water, and those airplanes would literally fly right over the top of us as they would depart going southbound, mainly to St. Croix. That was their main route from St. Thomas to St. Croix. So that's really where my inspiration came from. When I got a little older and got a bicycle, I would sneak down. I would ride my bicycle around the circumference of a harbor and go down and hang out on the ramp by the ramp. And of course, eventually got inside the fence and got into the hangar, just absorbed the smell and the sights of all those magnificent flying machines. And, you know, the pilots were just like gods to me. I was so amazed by what they did. And, you know, I was around the water my whole life. So I was very familiar with the water. I've always sailed and surfed and scuba dived. And so to be able to see an airplane that would take off and land on the water was just amazing. And that put the hook in me. That just sealed the deal. That's what I decided I wanted to do at a very young age.
So was there any flight training providers over in the Virgin Islands there to be able to pursue that career once you left school?
Oh, no, not at all. So what ended up happening with Antilles, though, right at the very end of the 70s, unfortunately, Charlie Blair was killed in a tragic goose accident. He was doing a flight from St. Croix to St. Thomas, and he was about 10 miles south of St. Thomas, and the left engine's number 5 cylinder gave way, and it took out the cowling of the engine. And he tried to fly it down to more sheltered water, but he ended up putting down out there in the open ocean, and it took his life and the life of a couple of his passengers. A few people survived, but the goose sank to the bottom of the sea, and it really sent shockwaves through the community, the island community, and the aviation community, really. It was a very bad day in paradise. So a couple years later, I did graduate from high school, and I went to Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida, to start my flight training. And I spent 5 years there doing that, and graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Aeronautical Science and my commercial instrument multi-engine land rating. And right before I graduated, I learned from my parents that a new seaplane operation was starting up down there. Now, that one was called Virgin Island Seaplane Shuttle. So I was like really excited about that, because I had pretty much thought that I wasn't going to get to fly seaplanes because the first operation shut down. And so I got on the phone and called the chief pilot down there and asked him, I told him what I had done and what my flight time was. I had a grand total of 225 hours of flight time. Most of the guys I graduated with were going to get their CFI ratings so they could instruct or build their flight time. Once I found out a seaplane operation was starting back up again, that was where I was focused. And he told me, well, great, you're in good shape. All you have to do is get a multi-engine seaplane rating and be here.
Yeah, right.
So that's all I needed to hear. And so I sold everything I had, and I went over to Jack Brown Seaplane Base in Winter Haven, Florida, which is near Orlando, and got my multi-engine seaplane rating in a twin CB, and hightailed it back down to St. Thomas and moved back in with my parents and started camping out on the same ramp that I had as a kid. And every time the chief pilot flew, I was standing there smiling and ready to go.
So the operation must have changed a fair bit, though, from those old radial engine aircraft to what it was now that you're looking off the ramp. What had changed?
Well, what had changed was that the gooses were no more, and they had mallards. They had 3 round engine mallards, and they had 3 mallards with the Fred Frakes conversion, the PT-6s on them. So they had 6 airplanes in all. It was a much more modern fleet, and it was just better run. They were doing very well. They were flying quite a bit. And a couple months after I was there on the ramp, I got the call to come to work for them. So I went to ground school over in St. Croix and went through flight training on the round engine mallard. And the next thing I know, I'm flying the line in a 40-year-old twin engine powered seaplane and just loving life.
That would have been cool.
And I was getting paid to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
My pay was $200 a week.
Oh, it must have been good money back then, surely, wasn't it?
Well, not really. I mean, it was $186 a week after taxes.
After tax, yeah, right.
So I moved out of my parents' house into a 200-year-old villa that was located right up the hill from the waterfront, from the seaplane base. And my rent was $400 a month, so that left me with an abundance of $86 a week. But it was all good, because I would walk down some steps and walk along the waterfront to get to work in the morning. And that's where all the island ferries would dock that had brought up produce from down island. So I had plenty of fruits to buy, and there was some local bakeries in town. I would stop and get this amazing coconut bread and banana bread. And that's what I lived on. And that's what I did for the first year I was with the company.
Mate, it kind of sounds like the dream, though, like living up on the top of a hill on a villa, just looking out over the ocean, and then just down below you there, there's piston and turbine mallards just running out, you know, doing the trips out to the islands. It's making me very jealous, mate. This sounds like an absolute dream.
It was.
This area.
And I knew it was a dream the whole time I was there. It was just an amazing experience.
So did you start off as a first officer there, or was it multi-crew work out of those aircraft?
Right. It was a multi-crew aircraft. I was a green first officer. I mean, I had 225 hours total time. That's it. And wow. So I rode in the right seat of the round engine for a year. And then it came to be time to, I got the chance to transition into the right seat of the turbine Mallard.
Oh yeah.
But to do that, I had to move to St. Croix, where the company was headquartered. So moved to St. Croix I did. And
do you get into another villa?
Yeah, I did. But there was another old villa there, right a couple of streets up from the seaplane ramp in Christiansted, which is the name of the town in St. Croix. And that villa was owned by an elderly lady from the island of Malta in the Mediterranean. And she also had an estate on the island of Nevis and a hotel on St. Martin. So there was three rooms there at the villa that she rented to other pilots. But unfortunately for me, they were all occupied. However, as luck would have it, on the property, there was also a small theater where they would do live plays and performances every so often. And on the stage of the theater, there was all this furniture that was there as props, right? There was a bed, there was a chair, a couch, a table, and lamps. So for the first 2 or 3 months, I moved and I lived on the stage. I slept on the bed on the stage.
Wow.
Until a room opened up, and then I moved into one of the rooms. So it was quite a setup.
That's real GA living, that
is. Oh, yeah. Well, hey, I mean, what difference does it make? I was flying twin-engine Mallards around the Caribbean. I was single. It didn't matter at all, you know? It was a real kind of a band of brothers at that time. We all were there just enjoying what we were doing and didn't really care much about our sleeping accommodations.
And I don't think I would either if I'm doing that job or in that kind of area. That looks so good, like I said.
I know.
So what was the kind of flying like in those early days for you? Like where were you flying to, and how many, you know, flight hours a day and water landings a day were you doing with the Mallards?
Well, we flew, our milk run was between St. Thomas and St. Croix. That was where the most of the flights took place. But we also had a flight over to Cruise Bay, St. John. It went about twice a day, and twice a day there was a flight that went to West End, Tortola, which is in the British Virgin Islands, just east of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And they were busy days. I mean, we were running a scheduled airline, and it would not be unusual to fly to log 8 or 9 hours a day and maybe do 10 or 12 landings a day.
Wow.
It was a busy time.
It's a lot different to what we do here with the Mallards. I mean, we're doing kind of 2-hour sectors on average, and then kind of sharing that water landing at the other end, especially if it's just a return flight. And
right.
So it would have been really cool to do lots of like shuttle type flying where you're kind of doing these island hops and milk runs, like you said, just on and off the water all day long. That would have been really good.
Yeah, that's mainly what we were involved in until later on. They decided to open up a route over to San Juan, Puerto Rico, and that was going to be to the international airport there. That was going to be a land destination. So we started flying over there, and it became a very popular route, flying from San Juan direct to St. Thomas and to St. Croix. And we even had a flight that went direct to St. John, which really saved a lot of time, because usually the only way to get to St. John was by ferry from St. Thomas. So you'd have to fly to St. Thomas and then take a taxi to the other side of the island to get a ferry to St. John. So that shaved a lot of time off of that flight.
Yep.
That became very popular.
So getting around in the Mallard and moving to all of these islands, like obviously these days I'm imagining that there's probably mostly runways on the islands to get around, or they're just using ferries now. Were you landing on the water like basically all the time and then just ramping the airplanes, or did you use docks, or how are the passengers handled there?
No, with the Mallards, we had ramps at every location.
Yeah, right. So it was basically a water landing and then a ramping straight away.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, crazy. We with our Mallards, we just did a flight down to near Sydney last year for the Rathmines Catalina Festival, which is a seaplane festival in Australia. It's a festival that is based around a World War II Catalina base, and they generally have a Catalina that flies in, isn't unable to touch the water anymore. But we flew the Mallard down on a safari, a five-day safari last year, and took some lucky people through basically middle of Australia, down the coast, and then on that weekend we did some scenic flights off the water there.
Nice.
And it had a ramp. It had this old Catalina World War II ramp, and it was actually the first time that we had ramped our 18 Mallards, the different turbine Mallard that we have, in the 30 years, because we just don't use ramps ever. So it was actually really cool just, you know, being able to throw the gear down in the water and drive up the ramp there and use the stairs. I'd previously done some ramping stuff in the Whitsundays and also in Vietnam with caravans and beavers, but
right,
ramping the Mallard was cool. Were those ramps quite steep?
Most of them were in pretty good shape. The one in St. John was pretty steep. You had to be very careful coming down it or else you would bang the tail. But those ramps, there were days when getting the airplane up and down the ramp was the most challenging part of a flight. I mean, the wind in the can get really howling down there, and the water can get very rough.
And were they very wide ramps?
Not as wide as you would want. There was a seawall on each side, and there's probably only 5 feet off the end of each wingtip. So you had to be, you know, fairly committed once you started inside that channel way, or else you might hit a seawall. Some guys, unfortunately, did a couple of times when they took it in a little too far and got themselves caught there in a bind going up the ramp. I mean, there are days when you'd have the upwind engine at max power and the downwind engine in max reverse to keep the airplane straight to get up the ramp when it was blowing hard.
At least you had that differential power, I guess, with the turbines. But what about the radial Mallard?
Well, if it ever got to that point during a day, we'd take the radio Mallards off the schedule and just park them up for the day because they didn't have that capability. Now, there were some other tricks of the trade we could use that helped a little bit. Like, for instance, whenever you landed with the radio Mallard, you would open the cowl flaps, right, for cooling.
Yeah.
Because the airplane is not in the air. So the technique would be if you needed a little extra power on the upwind engine, you close the cowl flaps on that side. It would give you a little bit extra thrust.
Okay.
But you just have to be darn sure you were going to make it up, because if you got too close and you got a wind gust and that nose started coming around, you had no more power to correct that. So,
yeah, and then you've got full power on one engine committing to the ramp that you're not going to make. It would have been pretty messy.
Right. It did happen a couple times. So, again, it's seaplane flying, there's a lot more variables and a lot more judgment involved. You just got to know when to say when.
And absolutely.
Sometimes we had to.
Yeah, the ramping I did in the Whitsundays, we had, it was at an island called Hayman Island, and it had a reef all the way around the actual marina, but they dredged out a bit of reef there so they could access the marina. But they had three sets of two big pylons basically running down the edge of the reef there, and you know, it wasn't too bad in the caravan because you had the turboprop with reverse as well, but coming in on the Beaver, and it wasn't much wider than the wingspan, you know, if you had a crosswind and then you got weathercocked in the Beaver, you could find yourself quite easily, you know, 90 degrees to that little run through the reef there, just idling, you know, using flaps and maybe even like tickling the mags,
right,
we used to call it.
Right, exactly.
Just to drop the RPM as low as possible so that you didn't go forward onto the reef or backwards onto the reef, and you'd have to kind of do this sideways sail back out of that little leads. Some crazy techniques, and I could only imagine that doing it in the Mallard in open ocean, rough water would have been pretty hard.
Yeah, it definitely keeps things interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
To say the least.
The seaplane life, mate, that's why we do it, hey?
I know, it's true.
Now, so you said you just moved on to the turboprop to do some first officer flying. What was the progression from there?
Well, from there, like I said, they opened the routes of San Juan, and We flew, though. This was the first time we flew on IFR flight plans. All the other flights were VFR, down low. We hardly ever got above 1,500 feet. And the only navigational aids we used was the ADF on the aircraft, picking up the AM radio stations on the islands that we would just, you know, point the needle and go. Plus, we knew where we were going anyway just by heading.
Was that so you could listen to the cricket as well, was it?
Well, no. No, we did listen to some reggae music, though. That was my favorite thing to do. And get the local news for the next carnival coming up, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But so that, you know, flying to San Juan kind of stretched out our schedule. And besides that, they became so popular that we decided to open up some routes that left San Juan late in the evening, because people wanted to go to San Juan and spend the day and shop, but they didn't want to have to leave in time for us to get back to the St. Thomas or St. Croix for a daytime landing. It got dark. So we would take off out of San Juan International at like 7 or 8 o'clock at night and then go to the airport in St. Thomas and then over to the airport in St. Croix. So that really stretched out our manpower. And so I got to the point where it was time for me to upgrade to captain. So I went ahead and took my ATP written, and then they started looking at me to upgrade. And that was a great experience. I flew with all the senior guys and one by one got their approval, and finally got my ATP check ride at the same time I did my G73 type rating in the same check ride. And just like that, it was upgraded to captain. I was 28 years old and had 1600 hours and flying the job of my dreams.
Yeah, that's crazy. 28. I was 29 when I got my Mallard command rating, so you bet me by a year.
Right.
But
yeah.
Sounds like you had a bit more of a head start, you know, getting on the Mallard at 250 hours compared to me, but
right.
That's 28 would have been epic being a command Mallard pilot in those areas. But you talk about flying from airport to airport as well. That's one of the cool things about the Mallard is it's basically just a big twin engine land aeroplane that can land on the water, isn't it? So like, doesn't really matter if you're doing runway trips. It still is probably the great aeroplane and the right choice for the area anyway.
Yeah, it's essentially like a big King Air that can land and take off on the water. It's got the same engines, basically the same payload, same, you know, airspeed. Doesn't quite have the same range, but yeah, it's very versatile, no question about it.
So an ATP was needed for these aircraft back in the day as well?
Well, it wasn't necessarily needed, but it was a rating that, you know, was the next logical step up from the commercial instrument rating. ATP is just kind of like the master's degree, I guess you would say, of aviation. It was something that definitely should be done, I think, in anybody's career.
Yeah. With the gross weight increase of the Mallard into a turbine in Australia as well, we require the ATP to be a command pilot for the for the Mallard. So, did you find porpoising a big factor when you learnt to fly the Mallard?
Oh,
or was kind of coming
that
into...
airplane is notorious for that, especially the turbine Mallard when you're light, because those turbines have so much power, and that airplane just leaps onto the step. And, you know, you got to be on top of where your elevator inputs are, or else you get out of cycle and you're going to really do some damage to the airplane.
Yeah, I find that as well. You know, just there's so much power. And I say to people as well that flying the Mallard, especially light, it's like trying to tame a raging bull, isn't it? Like, it just leaps out of the water, and you've got to get that attitude on the water set so quickly, otherwise it just goes out of sequence with the porpoising, and it can turn pear shape really quickly. So,
well, not only that, there's just tremendous torque on the airplane. The airplane inherently wants to turn to the left.
Yep.
And you know, the left float is always in the water unless you have a strong crosswind from the left. But generally speaking, the first thing you got to do is get on the step, and the second thing you got to do is get that left float out of the water. And so you're always taking off with your ailerons full right aileron, and usually full right rudder to keep the airplane going straight. And I mean, there were days down there where the wind's blowing so hard, you you have full right aileron, full right rudder, and you put the power up and the airplane is still going left. And so really the only choice you have is to pull back the right engine until you can get the airplane kicked around in the direction you want to go. I mean, if you're heavy, the last thing you want to do is pull back the power on one of your engines as you're trying to climb on the steps. So sometimes you just push them both up at the same time, let the airplane go left, get on the step, then pull the right engine back, kick the nose around to the right, then bring the right throttle back up. At the same time, you're trying to keep the thing from porpoising. I mean, it's a handful.
Yeah.
It is an absolute handful. I didn't experience that in the Twin Otter. Those two floats track straight through the water, no issues at all.
Yeah. It's so cool that you say that, because it sounds exactly like what we have to deal with every day.
Oh, yeah.
In our Mallard, you know, like exactly what we're doing. We're putting the power up. Generally, we lead with the left engine as well to keep it straight. And then obviously in the multi-crew role, you're kind of leaving, you know, maybe a 1,000 foot-pound on the right engine. Where max takeoff's about 1,600. You're setting full power on the left, and then you're just calling for the FO to set the power for you because you're battling on the controls to keep this thing straight. And we've had aborted takeoffs before where I've had one where the plane just literally just would not go straight at all, and it just almost did a full 360.
Oh, yeah.
And it couldn't get that left float out of the water. And then other times where you're kind of like, yep, I'm just going to take off to the right-hand side of this boat here and it'll be all good. We shouldn't swing too much. And all of a sudden you're pointing straight at this boat and you've got to abort the takeoff because it's just that left swing. So it's crazy to see that you guys also were battling with that back in the day as well. I don't see why it should change, but it's kind of cool. Over 50 years, everyone's been doing the same thing, you know?
Do you have inertial separator doors on your engines?
Yeah, we do. So we've got electric inertial separators.
So obviously the technique is you have them open when you're on the water. So any spray that gets induced into the intake, theoretically, some of it will bypass the engine, right? And then when you're on this step, you close the doors, right?
We don't do that. We only deploy the separators for rough water operations. Generally, you guys had, I think, a lower on the Frakes turbine. You guys had a lower air intake. Nacelle there, whereas the AT Mallard, the Australian turbine Mallard, has had a difference in the cowling design there, where the air intake's a little bit higher. So on a normal smooth day, we won't require the separators at all, because real stress of it.
Yeah, we always use them. There was smooth days like 3 times a year. It just never happened. The wind was always blowing. And we did our best to protect. You know, every night they would do an engine wash in the compressor section. There was a little fitting on the bottom of the engine that they would hook a hose up to and pump a chemical wash into the compressor section to wash the blades, because they would just get a lot of salt residue on them all throughout the day.
A power recovery wash?
Yeah. There were some days when the water was so rough, what would happen is we would inject by midday, we would have ingested so much despite our best efforts. I mean, when we're on the water, we deploy the doors. It's, you know, like I said before, some days you've got max power on the upwind engine and max reverse beta range on the downwind engine just to keep the airplane straight to get up the ramp. There's so much salt spray everywhere, it's just a ball of salt spray. So you're ingesting salt water into those engines. And about midday, we get to the point where when you go to take off power, your ITTs would temp out before you got your maximum power setting. So obviously that's not good. You need max power for takeoff, especially if you lose an engine. You need, you know, your single engine performance is predicated on your max power of your good engine. So we'd have to cease operations for an hour and do a engine wash midday.
Yeah, right.
And wash those engines, because the abuse those PT6 engines went through is phenomenal. I can't believe that they held up like they did. I mean, I did have come apart on me on a takeoff one time out of St. Thomas. It did eat the turbine section, finally ate itself up, and there was a little bit of a boom, and I looked out and there was about a 5-foot flame coming out of the stack. I was in the right seat on that one. So thankfully we had just lifted off the water and there wasn't anybody ahead of us. So we just aborted the takeoff and landed. And I reached up and hit the fuel shut off, and the fire went out immediately. But that engine ate itself alive, and I can't believe only one of those did that over all those years. That's the only one that I'm aware of that ever failed like that. We had several of the round engines, you know, blow a jug every once in a while, and never had to feather the engine, just pull it back to idle and land. And we, you know, don't forget, if you're single engine in the water, have you ever had to get back up the ramp with one engine? That's
no.
An adventure. That's, I mean, you got to get a boat. You got it. We
not
had
exactly.
A dinghy that was like never used. That day that happened, of course, they couldn't get the engine started on the boat, on the dinghy. So that was, we're out there going around in circles. So they got another boat. Then they tie a rope to the other side, to the failed engine side pontoon. And so we got to try to coordinate getting to the ramp with one engine running and then the boat pulling the other side of the airplane till you get to the ramp. Then they had to transfer the rope to a car that was on the ramp. I mean, talk about a three-ring circus.
Yeah, that must have been incredible. I mean, everyone probably doesn't realize that the Mallard steering on the water is all dependent on the engines, not water rudders. They don't have water rudders. So
no, or brakes.
Yeah, brakes, exactly.
It's
yeah.
all your rudder, or if that doesn't work, which most of the time, if that's not enough, which most of the time it isn't, you have to use differential power.
Hmm.
It's a whole different dimension that most people don't think about.
I feel like I'm a bit of a fraud saying that I'm that Mallard guy, mate. You should take over that that title, I think. Or a few of these old school dudes should, because, I've got nothing on these guys.
Well, keep doing it long enough. You'll have some adventures too.
Exactly.
Just all I got to say is just always err on the side of caution and be on the constant lookout for error chains that are starting. You know, most aviation accidents are not from one big thing. It's just it's just a series of little tiny links that by themselves wouldn't normally cause an issue, but you link them together, you get an error chain, and now you're going to have an unplanned event on your hands. And in seaplanes, usually you're in the water someplace, you don't have any help. It's a lot more complicated than being stuck on a runway or on an airport someplace.
Oh, absolutely. You're just exposed so much more as a seaplane pilot.
Oh, yeah.
To all those threats, you know, so.
Well,
that's great advice.
Our company, this VIC Plane Shuttle's official company motto was, "Landing on water is fun." That was on all of our brochures. That's what the management decided to call our company's motto. But us in the front of the airplane had another motto, and that was, "Landing on water is dangerous." And you just have to always use your superior judgment so you don't have to use your superior skill. I mean, that's like the seaplane pilot's proverb right there. I'll take judgment over skill any day. Knowing to say when, and just be careful out there.
And that's something, you know, like you can't teach in an endorsement or, you know, on the first day. It's, you know, I get asked from people, you know, what's the wave height limitation for, you know, how choppy can you take these airplanes into? And it's like, oh yeah, we've got a book figure that says 2.5 feet. But
right.
How do you judge 2.5 feet doing 90 knots over the water?
I know.
When there's wind chop versus ocean swell that's coming the other way, and, you know, that all comes down to judgment, and that takes a long time to perfect.
Exactly. Not to mention the rogue fairy wake that surprises you out of nowhere, you know?
Yeah, that you can't see or, yeah.
You're always on the lookout for boats that are throwing out wakes, and as you're coming in, you can see them and you can see the wakes, but every once in a while, a boat will have gone by and it's long gone. Well, that wake is still out there, and you can get surprised hitting a wake. I mean, you can do some damage just hitting a 2-foot boat wake. If you're in a vulnerable position on the water, it can cause some damage. I mean, I've knocked a hole in the bottom of one time we were departing out of St. John, which is notorious for ferry wakes. It's was kind of the most open water place we operated out of. And, you know, we came out of Cruz Bay, we turned the corner there in the area called Caneel Bay, where we did our takeoffs. And you're looking for ferry wakes back and forth. I mean, you're looking for ferries and there's none anywhere. So put the power to it. We get up on the step. We're just about ready to lift off. And all of a sudden there's a rogue ferry wake. and we hit the first wave just right, and it just thumped the hull of the airplane, and it kind of launched us. I mean, it wasn't anything terrible that we hadn't experienced before. So we climb out, we're on our way back to St. Croix, and all of a sudden we're like smelling this weird smell. Like, what is that weird smell? It kind of smells musty and maybe a little oily. So we're looking around. I'm looking into the back of the airplane. Everybody's sitting back there looking out the window, happy as can be. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. It happened to be my leg. So we come into St. Croix and the Christian said, and there's that landing area is actually the best because there's a barrier reef that kind of shelters the harbor from the ocean waves. And on that day, thankfully, the wind was relatively light and out of the southeast. So our approach to landing was basically straight in towards the ramp. So you land, you come off the step, you put the gear down, and you go up the ramp basically in the same vector. You don't turn. So as soon as we touch down on the water, the sensation I have is we're slowing down too fast. We're decelerating too quick. Next thing I know, I'm hearing all this yelping in the back of the airplane. I look over my left shoulder, and there's a geyser of water that's blasted up through the floorboards and hitting the ceiling, and just it's like a fountain back there. Everybody's getting soaked because obviously we have a hole. The hole has been breached. So the captain immediately takes I'm in flight idle by then. So we fall off the step. He immediately calls for the gear down. He pushes the throttle up. And so we're like almost on the plane trying to make it to the ramp and hoping the gear comes down in time. We look out the side of the windows. All the gear is down. I look in the nose compartment. The gear is down. We start up the ramp, and he has to use full power to get out of the water, which is the good news. The bad news is there's so much water in the back of the airplane that the tail is dragging and the nose wheel is up in the air.
Oh, wow. On the ramp as well.
I know. So we kind of get almost to the crest of the ramp, and he has no choice but to shut down the engines. So he shuts down the engines, and of course the ramp guys come running out and open the back door, and this waterfall comes out of the airplane. And the guy I'm flying with, he's kind of a funny guy. He always had a sense of humor. He's like, "Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to St. Croix." And everybody is like in shock. Half the people are laughing. And then like everybody gets off, and the guys are like trying to get their luggage out, and their luggage is all soaked. And finally enough water drained out of the back of the airplane that the nose wheel settled back down. And so we just started the airplane back up and taxied it on the ramp over by the maintenance hangar and shut down and got out. And what has happened is that somebody over the years had riveted a small patch on the hull just forward of the step. And the way we hit that boat wake just right made that patch fold in, and we started leaking when we hit the ground and hit the water. So what we were smelling was the draft of the bilge coming up through that hole and into the airplane all the way over to St. Croix.
And like you said before, like the links all lined up, wasn't it? It's an old maintenance patch that's been, probably 5-10 years old or whatever, and a rogue boat wake, and it's the links that joined together that caused the incident.
Exactly. Long story short, that was just another day on the job, and a couple of days later, the airplane was fixed and it was back on the line. Just like it never happened.
Exactly. I just love that comment. Just, welcome to St. Croix.
I know.
It sums up being a float pilot so much. I think you gotta go with whatever's happening at the time and just make the best of it, don't you?
Yeah, most of the passengers down there that we had, the locals, were well aware of the type of operation it was. It was safe. It was really a safe operation. The guys I flew with were amazing, old school, just gruff and tough guys that didn't take a coarse word off of anybody, but they were all very safe, and the passengers were characters in themselves. I mean, heck, one of the things that why the airline was so popular is because you didn't have to go to the airports, which was a lot more structured, and there was security around, and there was this basset hound. You know what a basset hound is? It's this kind of a short dog
Yeah, okay.
It looks like a dachshund, but a lot more beefy.
Yep.
There was this basset hound that lived on St. Thomas. His name was Beauregard. And nobody really knew who this dog belonged to. He was all over the island. One day he was on the east end, the next day he was in town, the next day he was on the north side. Well, this dog used to ride on the seaplane. Then a couple of weeks later, you see him on St. Croix. Well, how the heck did he get to St. Croix? I don't know. Somebody put him on the seaplane and they brought him over to St. Croix. And he spent a couple of days roaming around St. Croix. And then the next thing you know, he's back on St. Thomas. I mean, you never see that in today's world. And
no, exactly.
Everybody is so upset over everything. But down there, it's just like the carnival is always going on. Don't stop the carnival. Everything goes, sort of. And, you know, it's just at the end of the day, you just look back and you're just marveled at the things that you see and you experience.
Exactly. So what happened after that? You know, arm out the window, chilling out, you know, flying around the beautiful Virgin Islands as a captain on the Mallard.
Yep, you hit the nail on the head. I was like Captain Fantastic. I mean, I could do no wrong. It was just an amazing time to work those hard days on the water, in the airboats, and on my days off, I was sailing, surfing, scuba diving, swimming to the outer reefs. I mean, I got a raise. I was making a grand total of $2,000 a month now. I was rich. And so I moved to a nicer place on the beach. I mean, I picked out my piece of land I was going to build my house on. All was well in paradise, that's for sure. Unfortunately, sometimes God has different plans. And later on that year, St. Croix got hit by a major hurricane. Hurricane Hugo came through. And it did heavy damage to the island. And unfortunately, we only were able to fly out two of the airplanes. We only flew out one round engine and one turbine airplane. And you're probably thinking to yourself, why in the heck did they leave the other ones behind? And the reason is because in September and October, it's usually our slowest months. And so that's when we schedule our heavy maintenance on the aircraft.
Yeah.
So it just was, and plus, you know, some of it was complacency as well, because before Hurricane Hugo hit, no major hurricane had hit anywhere in the Caribbean for 60 years.
Wow.
You know, they always turn, you know, yeah, go on turn, man. That's all I'm going to turn. Don't worry about that. You know, that's, as a matter of fact, before Hugo, there was another storm, Gabrielle, that came, was coming our direction. And we did evacuate three planes. I was involved in that flight. We went to Ponce, Puerto Rico on the south side. And the next day we got up, the storm turned, we flew back. And there was an epic north swell coming in, which I surfed as soon as we got back, you know, so it's like the same old story. But Hugo had different plans. Usually, you know, the airplanes we left behind, you know, they had an engine off. One of them had the empennage off. One of them had the landing gear off. Other one had the hull taken apart because the hulls take a beating. And so we always are repairing the hulls. So the company was destroyed.
That's terrible.
Paradise Lost. It was heartbreaking. I mean, it just was, I couldn't believe it. Virgin Island seaplane shuttle was no more.
Wow.
And the sound of those seaplane engines echoing in the harbors of the Caribbean were silenced. And the scene on St. Croix was widespread looting and lawlessness and just, it basically got knocked back 100 years in time. No power, no phones, no TV, no radio. It was pretty bad. So it was a couple months before I could leave the island. I went back to St. Thomas to help my parents and my grandparents recover. They didn't get hit quite as bad as St. Croix did. I mean, I literally wept more than a few times over the paradise I had lost. It was heartbreaking.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people did at that time as well.
Yeah. But little did I know, there was another seaplane operation in my future, but not one that I expected.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, once things slowly started recovering in the islands, especially St. Croix, at the airport, there was a, let me digress just for a second. At the airport, there was a charter operation there that managed to ferry out all their airplanes after the storm. They brought them back. And because the hospital on St. Croix was completely shut down and the one on St. Thomas was barely open, there was a huge need for air ambulance work in the Caribbean. And so anybody that was critically ill or needed serious hospitalization was needed to be airlifted to San Juan, or if it was really bad, over to up to the States. So I began to work for them. They had a Cessna 402, a Piper Seneca, a Turbo Commander, and a Jet Commander. I flew for them for a year or so, and I had heart attack victims and shooting victims and stabbing victims. By far, the hardest ones to take were the preemie babies and incubators that I had.
Yeah, I've got a mate as well who flies out of Sydney.
Yeah.
As an aeromed pilot, and he said that he can kind of cope quite easily with the normal, you know, adult victims, but it's the kids and the babies that are the hardest to take.
It was very rewarding though to be able to help out folks, you know, but. You know, it just seemed like all these flights happened in the middle of the night and I was single pilot. And I mean, as nice as the weather is in the daytime in the Caribbean, at night, it's like a coal mine. It's so dark out there and you just learn to get sharp on your instruments right away, you know. But in the meantime, there was a gentleman over in San Juan that bought the two mallards that survived the hurricane, the turbine mallard and the round engine mallard. And so he was going to try to get the operation going again. And he needed to negotiate with the Port Authority in the Virgin Islands to get access to the ramps. They owned the land that the ramps were on. So he hired me, brought me on as chief pilot. And I kind of was just worked for him part time while he was trying to get that operation going. And in the meantime, I flew his family around to the outer islands for beach days on the turbine mallard. I never did get my type on the round engine mallard. I was about to before the hurricane hit, but it didn't work out.
So you didn't need a type rating as an FO?
Not as an FO, no.
Okay.
Only as captain. And since anything over 12,500 pounds, you need a type rating.
For both seats or just the command seat?
The command seat.
Okay. Yeah, right. So you can just be an FO on most aircraft without a type rating.
Yes.
Okay.
And the max gross takeoff weight of the round engine mallard was 12,750. So it was above the 12,500.
Yeah.
And of course, as you know, it was increased to 14,000 pounds on the turbo mallard.
Yeah.
So he also was able to get some contracts with some media production companies. I flew the turbine mallard down to Anguilla once, the island of Anguilla, which is an island just north of St. Martin. And we did a commercial for a French chocolate company. And later on, we were involved in the production of a Chinese martial arts movie that was filmed in San Juan, or just outside of San Juan on the Luisa River. So that's my 3 minutes of fame. Still waiting for my call from the Oscars, but
yeah.
I haven't heard from them yet.
Is that on YouTube or anything? Can we see a copy of that somewhere?
It's on YouTube. I'll send you a link to it. Yeah, it's there. It's exactly 3 minutes.
Okay.
I even have a headshot. It's one of those movies where the lips don't match the dialogue, know, typical Chinese martial art, a lot of blowing up and fighting. And
I don't think that sounds like, you know, with the lip syncing, that probably won't get you an Oscar, mate, but you might get a Logie if it had been in Australia.
That's true. So anyway, I was doing those two things and time was dragging on and he just never got the lease to the seaplane ramps back in St. Thomas and St. Croix. Typical government bureaucracy, and it just dragged on and on and on. And that hope for that new operation actually faded away over time. But then, a couple years later, to my surprise, a Twin Otter on floats shows up in the harbor in St. Thomas out of nowhere.
Wow.
And they start using a dock a floating dock over on the other side of the harbor from where the seaplane ramp was, that's near the cruise ships, where the St. Thomas has many cruise ships that come in. And so I went down to track them down and see what the heck was going on. And it turns out they were a group of bush pilots from Alaska, from Ketchikan, Alaska. And their company was called Seabourne Seaplane. And what they did is, in Ketchikan, the cruise ships come in there in the summertime, and they would take sightseeing passengers off the cruise ship on sightseeing tours and fly them over the glaciers. Now, in the wintertime, the cruise ships leave Alaska and they all move to the Caribbean. So they decided to follow the cruise ships to the Caribbean, and they started doing sightseeing tours over the U.S. and British Virgin Islands, over the same waters I grew up on, the same waters I was on every weekend as a kid on my family's boat. I started talking to them a little bit, and I don't know if it was through me or through just being there, they got wind of the fact that there used to be seaplane operations going on there, and they decided to start up a service of their own between St. Thomas and St. Croix without the ramps.
Exactly. Yeah, the Twin Otter can quite easily use the docks out in the harbor there and don't really need to touch the ramp at all if they don't want to.
Exactly. Very easily done. And that's what they did. So they hired me, and off to Toronto, Canada, I went for my initial Twin Otter training, and came back and started flying right sea with them a little bit, and got to learn how the handling characteristics of a float operation and how to dock the aircraft, which was another chapter in seaplane flying. It can be very challenging at times. And in the meantime, they built another floating dock over in St. Croix in Christiansted Harbor, right in front of one of the hotels there. And we started flights over to St. Croix. It was very primitive at first. I mean, we just fly over there. We did some advertising. We fly over there, and whoever had $40 in cash got on the airplane. And we did that for a while, and it grew slowly as the locals saw the aircraft and word spread that the airline had started. And a year later, a second aircraft was added, and then a third.
So back to the old hunting ground again then.
I know. I was beginning to think my original plan of making a career out of flying seaplanes in the Caribbean was back on track. And I was like born again, sort of.
I bet.
It was a lot different. The Twin Otter handling characteristics are way different than the Mallard. But it was just an amazing aircraft to fly. I really wasn't sure about it initially, but I really grew to love that airplane. What a performer. What a performer that airplane is.
Well, it's had such a success all around the world, hasn't it? Like, especially in the Maldives, in pretty rough water over there. So probably makes sense to have that airplane in those areas there in the Virgin Islands as well. So, and it looks like they're still operating, but look, I'm just having a look at their website at the moment and still saying they've got two Twin Otters going.
They are. They've managed to last all these years.
Yeah, it's incredible. Nice looking Twin Otter as well there. Nice little paint job.
Oh, yeah.
So so how long did you fly for Seabourn?
Well, I flew with them for a good year and a half. And all things were going well. But unfortunately, in 1995, St. Thomas got hit by another major hurricane, Hurricane Marilyn this time. And it did the same amount of damage as St. Thomas as Hugo did to St. Croix. The only difference is that we were able to fly the airplanes out. They were flown out. And so the company survived the storm. And after a month or so, we brought them back and slowly reestablished service. But unfortunately for me personally, this time my parents' home, my home, was heavily damaged. My grandmother's home was completely leveled, uninhabitable. So she moved in with my parents. You know, they were all getting elderly, and this was the second hurricane in 6 years, and their health really started to go downhill. And so I kind of made the executive decision to get them to the States, closer to better health care and just, a normal life. So I worked for Seabourn for another 6 months after the storm and basically packed up my family, and I gave them a 2 months notice and resigned my position. And it was really a tough time. So after 31 years in the Caribbean, my whole family said goodbye to the island life. And those years were the best of times, and they were the worst of times.
Yeah, I guess sometimes there's a bit of a price to pay, isn't there, for living in such beautiful areas?
Yeah, in this case, it's true. So after I got everybody established in Florida, I seriously considered going back and flying again, but my heart just wasn't in it. After growing up in the innocence of the 60s and 70s and 80s down there, things were not the same to me. You know, all my friends were gone. My family was now gone. Our family boat was sunk. I felt like that was just the end of that era. And as it turned out, it was.
On a positive, though, you moved to Florida. Florida's sounds like a pretty amazing spot in the States to live.
Oh, yeah.
Especially on the water as well there. So,
right.
But probably would have felt pretty close to home being on the water down there in Florida.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I did get a chance to fly one more seaplane several years later. After I decided not to go back down to the islands, I just turned my attention to pursuing my career in up here in the States, and just thought back to the airplanes I used to fuel while I was in college. I worked across the airport at the FBO there, and just was really amazed with the Lear jets and the Gulfstreams that used to come in. And so I turned my attention in that direction and ended up flying the Lear jets. And I also flew the Hawker a little bit and the 4-engine Lockheed Jetstar. But then I was able to transition into the Gulfstream line of aircraft, which is where I am today. And it comes full circle because, you know, as you probably know, Gulfstream was started by Leroy Grumman. It used to be the Grumman Corporation.
I didn't know that.
The G1 was the Grumman, the first Grumman corporate aircraft he designed. Of course, as you know, he designed the Goose and the Mallard. It kind of comes full circle to me to be in the Gulfstream now, even though I started in the Grumman. He formed the company Gulfstream in, I think, the early 60s. They were in Long Island, New York then, and he, in the late 60s, moved the whole operation to Savannah, Georgia. He picked the name Gulfstream because there's a river of water that runs off the east coast of the United States from south to north, off of Florida, all the way up to Maine, and it's called the Gulfstream, and it's a warm river of water. It's when you start from the shore, the temperature is one reading. As you get out into the Gulfstream, the temperature actually rises. And that's where people go sport fishing. And a lot of his early clients were sport fishermen. They would fish off of Cape Hatteras in North Carolina and also here off of Florida. And they would all go out to the Gulfstream and they would fly their airplanes down there to get close to the water and then get in their boats and go out there to fish. So that's why he named the company Gulfstream.
Yeah, cool.
So in the process of doing all that, there was a company down in Fort Lauderdale I worked for that we had a G4. I flew a G4 for them. And the people we rented from were the owners of the Miami Dolphins football team. And these people had a humongous flight department. At one time, they had two BBJs, numerous Gulfstreams, numerous helicopters, and they had a Twin Otter on floats, on amphibious floats. So I just flew for them a little bit, taking that airplane out to the Bahamas and down to the Florida Keys on day trips. And that was the last time I flew a seaplane.
You would have been the model employee back then, flying the Gulfstream and the Twin Otter on floats.
I know. I tried to get on with them flying the Gulfstreams, but, you know, the timing just wasn't right. They didn't need anybody. And besides, they eventually sold the airplane, and sadly, the floats were taken off, and it was converted back to a land plane and sold. I think it went down to Central America someplace. The company I worked for there ended up buying a helicopter, a Sikorsky helicopter. And I went ahead and got my helicopter ratings and ended up flying that helicopter a good bit, which, again, is kind of full circle because, you know, most people don't realize that Igor Sikorsky started his career in this country manufacturing the giant airboats for Pan American.
Yeah.
He started flying doing helicopters in Russia, and he got to the point where he could figure out how to make them hover. But as soon as you try to go forward in a helicopter, it rolled. He couldn't figure that out. And then the Bolshevik Revolution happened, and he had to leave the country and came to the States and started making seaplanes in Long Island for one trip in Pan Am. And then he finally went back to helicopter business and figured out with flapping and feathering and all the other scary things that main rotors on helicopters are doing to keep it from rolling over when you go forward, when you increase in airspeed.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a cool little link as well.
Yeah. So that's basically the long and the short of it. Those stick and rudder skills I learned on the water are still with me today, and I consider that I'll always be a seaplane pilot at heart. I still have the salt water in my veins. You just can't see it beneath my buttoned-up shirt and tie now, but it's still there.
Yeah, you got those like stripper pants, you know, the ones you just rip off, and then you're in your swim shorts and bare feet.
That's a good idea. I'll have to consider that. I'm just thankful that, you know, of my story and how seaplanes influenced and enlightened my life, and I just thank God for all He's allowed me to do and got out of there with my skin, because there's a lot of guys that didn't. There's plenty of opportunity to get yourself in big trouble on the water, and some guys found it out, that's for sure.
Yeah. Oh, mate, it sounds like you had an incredible career and some really cool stories there, from flying the mallards and the twin otters back in paradise, basically. It sounds exactly like what everyone's dream seaplane job would be. And amazing that you got to experience those times, and especially growing up in an area where, you know, radial engine flying boats were coming in and over your head at school. Like,
I know.
What a great place to grow up and live and be exposed to.
I know. It's so funny, even to this day, whenever I talk to people, other pilots, about, you know, your career, or even when I go to interview for a job and they look at my resume, they don't want to talk about anything else but my days flying the seaplanes.
That's
all they want to talk about. Yeah. Every interview is just basically what I just told you.
Yeah, exactly. You've had some practice.
I know.
It's funny, a mate of mine who now flies for a major airline in Hong Kong, he used to fly the Mallard here as well. And, you know, like he flies with a new captain or someone, new pilot in the group or whatnot, and they get up in the air, and, you know, I imagine that the chat's kind of, you know, you haven't flown with these guys before, and the chat's pretty, what did you used to do? And as soon as he mentions the Mallard, everyone is just so, you know, gripped on his story, and he just talks Mallards the whole flight, and, you know, they love it. You know, it's just such a unique part of aviation, and especially when you think about only 59 of these aircraft ever been built. It's just such a rare occurrence to be able to fly them.
That's why I'm so excited to hear about you and your operation. And you remind me of me back when I was your age. It's almost the same age group, same airplane. And I'm just so excited that you guys are keeping the dream alive, keeping the legend going. And I really hope you all just really appreciate and just understand what you have going, and educate yourselves on the history of the men that came before us, and just understand what it is you're doing and appreciate the unique opportunity you guys have.
Yeah, we certainly do. That's like we kind of pinch ourselves every day, and especially in this time at the moment, you know, with COVID, everything, you know, we're still lucky to just be in a job, let alone flying amazing old seaplanes, you know. But mate, it's been really cool chatting to you and hearing your story about, you know, flying these airplanes around the islands there. It sounds amazing and making me very jealous of those times. But before we get going, I'd like to just go through a little questionnaire that I call the splash and dash questionnaire, just like a land plane touch and go, the seaplane splash and dash. We're just going to touch on a few questions there. I'm pretty sure you've answered most of them already, but we'll go through them and get your best answers. But first of all, what is your favorite seaplane that you have ever flown?
Definitely the round engine Mallard. Just the nostalgia, the sound of those engines, the smell of the oil and the gas, realizing the history. I logged almost 500 hours in that airplane, and I relish every single hour.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
Getting on the tail end of a radio powered anything, let alone a seaplane that's also radio powered. I mean, that's just an amazing blessing. So glad I got to do that.
Exactly. I mean, most float pilots start off on the Beaver, you know, as their as their radial engine kind of entry to that era.
Right.
But to fly a Mallard twin radio would have been pretty cool. Obviously, the Goose is still around flying twin radio.
It is. Yeah.
That would be pretty epic as well. What about, was the Virgin Islands your dream seaplane job, or is there some other seaplane job around the world that you would consider to be an absolute dream?
No, that was pretty much it. Just, I mean, there's so many, one of the things about the British and U.S. Virgin Islands is that there's so many small islands around them. So there's almost endless places you can anchor your boat, you can snorkel, you can scuba dive, you can windsurf. It's just a magical place to live and to sail and to fly seaplanes. I was brought up there, and it's just, I consider it my home, even though I haven't been there in over 20 years now. But that, I can't think of any place that was better than that.
It sounds pretty good to me after that story.
Yeah.
Now, what about, would there be a dream seaplane to fly? If you could just fly any seaplane, around the world, what would you pick? What would be your dream?
All right. Well, I've thought about this many times. And to me, if I had an endless funding, what I would do is I would get up with the Boeing Corporation and I would get the plans, the design of the Boeing 314, and I would put four turbine engines on that airplane and I would fly it around the world. I guarantee you that there would be a market for a fleet of those airplanes that did today what those guys did back in the day, flying around. And of course, with the turbines, it would be quieter, it'd be safer because you'd be burning Jet A. They'd be faster. You could maybe even pressurize them. That would be what I would do.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Put my name down there for a job once you sort that out, all right?
All right, well, I'm still working on the funding, but I'll let you know.
I can't help you out there, sorry.
Okay.
You've worked too long earning $200 a week, by the sound of it. Finally, mate, I'd like to finish with my last question, and that is, if you were to meet an aspiring seaplane pilot out there who maybe hasn't got their float endorsement, they're considering getting into the seaplane industry, what advice would you give to that pilot?
Well, it would help to get the seaplane rating that you're trying to get where you're trying to get a job. So make sure you have a single engine C rating or the multi-engine C rating. And just like I did, is you just got to be where the opportunity is and make your face known and meet the people that are in charge and show an interest. In today's world, everybody is online pointing and clicking. You know, everybody can point and click a resume. But to be on location, to show interest, to really, I mean, even if you have to pump gas into the airplanes, I mean, that might be what it takes. That shows initiative, and you get to know the operation from the ground up. And so when the opportunity arises, many, many times, whoever's standing right there gets the call. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me in my life. You send in a resume, you go knock on the door, you grip and grin, and you keep your face and your name at the top of the list. And when an opportunity arises, they almost always hire the guy that's standing right there.
That's exactly the advice that I give everyone who talks to me about that as well. It's, you know, we get resumes sometimes that from people who, you know, they hand their resume in and, you know, operations team are like, do you know what we actually fly here? Oh, no, not really. We fly Grumman Mallard seaplanes. Have you got any seaplane time? Oh, no, I don't. Okay, well, then why the hell are you dropping off your resume to a seaplane operator if you're not, you know, you don't even know what airplane we operate? You're never going to get a job like that.
Right.
But if you hang around, if you're interested and keen in the seaplane industry, I say exactly the same thing. Get out there, show your face to the operator. I say it a fair bit as well. Be a pest. But I'm going to steal your saying, the grin and grip.
Right.
That's a good one. I like that. I'm going to use that from now on. The grin and grip.
Right.
Get that happening, people. So if you're keen on getting the seaplane, show your face and grin and grip some people.
Yeah, and I mean, aviation is always a journey of growing, right? So you may not be able to get right into a twin-engine seaplane. You may start out with a single-engine seaplane. Okay, where are the single-engine seaplanes flying in the world? Well, a good place to start would be Alaska. I think there's a seaplane operation down in Miami here in Florida flying caravans on floats now.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Canada's a big one.
Canada, exactly. So you get yourself your single engine seaplane rate. I don't care if you have to wash cars. I mean, I sold everything I had, even my motorcycle. When I realized there was an opportunity to fly in St. Thomas, I did what had to get done. I got my seaplane rating and I went and I was there. And you go ahead and do that and you get your foot in the door and gain some experience flying single engine aircraft, single engine seaplanes. And then from there, man, your resume looks real good when you start knocking on the multi-engine seaplane rating doors.
Well, mate, like I said, thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been an epic chat. It's
been a pleasure.
I really, really love this chat. And hopefully there's more of them in the future. We've got a few little secret things in the pipeline between you and myself.
Oh, great.
So we might be hearing your voice again in the future. But for now, Michael, it's been an absolute pleasure. And thanks for coming on The Step.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that's the show for today, folks. What a legend Michael Steers is. Now, get some reviews in, everyone. Tell the world how much you love this podcast, and more epic content will come your way very soon. But before we go, here is a little taste test of episode number 9, and it sounds a little something like this.
Miss Pickup flew out into the North Sea to pick up a Mustang pilot had gone down into the drink. It landed on the North Sea, but then had an engine failure. And the hapless Mustang pilot drifted off into captivity. And the Catalina was stuck on the North Sea for, well, overnight. And come daybreak, they still couldn't start the engine, so they were stuck on the water. And it got shot up by a Luftwaffe Messerschmitt 262.
Until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.